Tiff number 12246, Lieutenant Colonel W. Waitman, Reel 18.
Colonel W.A. Waitman, Reel 18. At the end of your leave, Colonel, what was your rank?
I was still a full lieutenant, and having proceeded to London for the 3 days, then went by train to Taunton and by vehicle to the Transport Command Departure Air Trooping Airfield, RAF Merrifield, near Ilton, Ilminster in Somerset. On being checked out of customs, I reported to the customs officer, who was actually the same one on duty as when I'd arrived a month earlier. And I said, "I'm taking that Luger automatic pistol back with me." He said, "Which one's that?" I said, "The one you let me in with a month ago. You are fair with me, I'm being straight with you." We climbed into a Dakota and set off on the first leg for the journey back out to India. And we landed at Elmas, the airfield at Cagliari, Sardinia. We were told then that there was an oil leak, an engine fault, so we'd be staying the night. So once again, it was El Spam, bacon and egg, and a good night's sleep. We took off the next day, and 10 minutes after takeoff, one of the crew came back and said, "There's an engine cowling loose, we've got to go back." So we went back to Elmas, and the cowling was duly secured, and we took off again on the leg between Elmas and El Adam in Libya. Having got to El Adam again, we had the usual meal, some Spam, bacon and egg or whatever, and the crew were checking the aircraft and said that they'd got an oil leak on one of the engines, but they thought that we would reach Lydda in Palestine. And off we went down the Libyan coast, the Egyptian coast, passing Alexandria, and then finally crossing the coast of Palestine and landing at Lydda near Tel Aviv, large RAF airfield. We staged through Lydda for 4 days, awaiting our flight onward from Lydda to Habaneer. And while we were there, we read in the press and heard on the radio, of course, that a British police officer of the Palestine police had been killed by Jewish terrorists in Tel Aviv, a British officer, Berry, murdered by one of the terrorist organisations, either the Stern Gang or the I.Z. Earl, Irgun Zvi Loimi.
What was your response to that?
We were absolutely annoyed about this, irate. But of course it was one of many terrorist attacks on the British troops, which we just couldn't comprehend, because by and large the British and Allied forces had defeated Nazi Germany, who were oppressing the Jewish race before and during the war. We'd read of camps after the German surrender, we'd read of camps and seen photographs on the newsreels and in the press of camps such as Bergen-Belsen, Auschwitz-Birkenau and Dachau. So we were appalled that this terrorist attacks had gone on during the war and we're now continuing after the war against British service personnel in Palestine. We then got on another Dakota and flew to Habaneer and staged back progressively from Habaneer to Bahrain and from Bahrain to Mauripore, Karachi. I inquired from movement control and the movement's organisation where the 2nd Battalion and the Durham Light Infantry were. Were they still in Rangoon or had they moved? And on three different occasions from three different people, I was told that the battalion was still in Rangoon, that it was in Japan, and that it was somewhere in India. And I knew that Ahmednagar, the original firm base of the battalion, or Secunderabad, where our rear details were based, might be the location. So I decided to head for Calcutta, which was another location that movements thought the battalion might be based in. They were very good, and they gave me a flight on a flying boat, and I went down early one morning to the docks at Karachi as a passenger on this Solent flying boat, the civilian equivalent of the short Sunderland Coastal Command aircraft. We took off in the dark from Karachi Harbour, and daylight dawned, and we settled down for a very pleasant trip before landing on a beautiful lake at at Udaipur in Rajputana. A launch came out for us, and we were taken to a dark bungalow on an island in the middle of the lake and had a lovely meal. And this lake and the Lake Palace of Udaipur is now one of the famous tourist attractions of India. On emplaning again in the flying boat, we had another very pleasant flight to land on another lake at Gwalior. En route, we were given light meals on the flying boat and then another super curry meal at Gwalior. We got on board again and flew across central India to Allahabad, where we landed on the Jumna River. En route, an American Dakota came alongside us to take photographs. At one stage, looking down below, I got a beautiful view of quite a sizable waterfall in a jungle area. On board with us, apart from one or two Americans, was a British ENSA troop from the entertainments organisation. I struck up a friendship with a very attractive girl singer called Joanna Cochran. I thought she might have been connected with the famous producer C.B. Cochran, but she wasn't. Nevertheless, a very, very nice young lady indeed. She must have thought I was a bit of a funny one as I slept on the floor of the aircraft after leaving Karachi and caught up on lost sleep. After leaving Allahabad, we flew on to Calcutta, where we landed on the Hooghly River and then were conveyed to the Grand Hotel. I reported to movement control there, and they said, your battalion's at Pune, we'll get you on a train in a few days' time, and you can go by train from Calcutta to Pune and rejoin your battalion there. In the meantime, stay here and relax. I did, and had the very pleasant company of Miss Joanna Cochran for dinner on the two evenings I was in Cal. My movement order came through, and I met up with an Australian officer, Captain Owen Tinkham, who was an Australian reinforcement officer posted to the 2nd Durham's. From him I learned that owing to the shortage of infantry officers in 14th Army units after the Burma campaign, through casualties and disease, illness, and through repatriation, of course, which is now going into full swing for those that had done 4 years and the rest in India Command and Southeast Asia Command, the Australian forces very kindly were supplying us with infantry officers, and some jolly good chaps they were too. Owen Tinkham and I boarded the train at Howrah Station and then proceeded on the 3-day journey to to Pune via Nasik, Bombay, the big railway junction at Nazik and Kalyan. So instead of going to Bombay, we got another train to Pune. Owen Tinkham had a crate of beer with him, and we certainly kept ourselves cool on that journey. Transport picked us up at Pune, and I rejoined the 2nd Durhams on the 9th of October 1945 at Yeruli Camp, which was about 8 to 10 miles out of the city of Pune. We also met up with another Australian officer, Captain Alan Clifton, who joined us on the train journey.
How were you received at the battalion?
Just routine, just rejoining from leave, nothing special.
Have there been many changes?
Oh, quite a few changes, I'll come to in a moment. On the train, we met up with a couple with people just coming off a troop ship at Bombay. Reinforcements, chaps coming out, either posted to their own battalions, officers and men, or diverted to other battalions that were short. People changed cap badges quite often, of course, both in the war and post-war. But we met a couple of Queen Alexandra Nursing Service young ladies, and Alan Clifton and I arranged to meet them and take them racing at Pune, because there's a very good race course, the Turf Club of Western India in Pune. And we made a note of their names and the large military hospital in which they'd be serving. When we got back to the battalion, it had changed out of all recognition. Colonel Waterhouse, naturally, having got his 4 years and had gone, and we had a Colonel Quentin Finlater, who hadn't been in Burma. He must have been somewhere, because he had a 1939-45 star, the six-month Chowringhee star, as we called it. Whether he got that in France, the British Expeditionary Force, or whatever, I don't know. But no campaign stars. Certainly hadn't been in Burma. And he'd been posted as CO. We got a second-in-command who'd come from one of the Highland regiments of the 15th Scottish Division, Raymond Henderson. Fanning Evans was commanding headquarter company. He'd spent the war in Newfoundland, or Newfoundland, whatever you like to call it. He'd been 24 years in the Durham Light Infantry with a Defence Medal and War Medal to show for it. In the words of the lads, he's never seen an angry charwaller. Sergeant Major McLean, who had left the battalion after Kohima, was acting as RSM, and we were sorting ourselves out prior to going back on by sea to Malaya for the reoccupation of Malaya. Troops had already gone there, of course, the 5th Parachute Brigade, the 7th, 12th and 13th Parachute Battalion, the 5th Parachute Brigade, and other units of the Indian Army and British units, particularly 15th Corps, had already preceded us after the Japanese surrender on August 14. So we were more like a second wave. The reoccupation of Malaya, in fact, maintained the operational code name that it would have had, which was Zipper. And our second wave, I think the code name would be Button. While we were at Yuruli Camp Pune for 2 or 3 weeks, Alan Clifton and I took the two nurses racing at the Turf Club of Western India and saw how the other half lived, the people who'd been stationed in that area and not gone up to 14th Army. We did have preparations for going on to Malaya, weapon training particularly, rifle and Bren gun practices on the ranges, and one of the bright occasions was the whole battalion was ordered to do a cross-country run of about 6 miles. No PT shoes, we did it in boots. And at that time, I was quite a cross-country runner and went into the lead about a quarter of a mile from the finish. Whereupon I thought, well, I'd take the soldier who had just passed, Private Tracy, in with me. So I slowed down and said, come on, lad, we'll both go in together. And we ran in, as I'd seen it done at school, when people were going to cross the line together. And this we did. As I approached the finish, I noticed Fanning Evans coming across in his khaki shorts and swinging his bagger stick and exclaiming, what's going on here? So I let Private Tracy's hand go and said, go on, lad. And I walked the last three or four strides just to show my sort of opinion of the Fanning Evans of this world. The battalion was then taken by train to Bombay Docks at the beginning, first week of November, or at the end of October or the beginning of November, and we embarked on a Dutch liner, the Sibbejak. We sailed and we saw the twinkling lights of Ceylon, Cape Comorin, what is now Sri Lanka, and we sailed down the Straits of Malacca. Through our binoculars, we could see lovely buildings on occasions as we went down the Straits of Malacca, and we realised that we were going to a different world to what we'd seen in Burma, that there would be houses and bungalows, and the lovely red roofs stood out clearly against the jungle background and the palm trees and rubber plantations. We landed at Singapore and were then conveyed across the island and across the causeway to Johor Bahru, which lies on the Malay Peninsula, mainland side of the Malay Peninsula. We were in a pre-war barracks and charpoys had arrived, so we were no longer kipping on the floor. And the battalion were based in barrack blocks, and we officers in small pre-war married quarter bungalows. We settled in there, and one of my first jobs was to go unobtrusively with a truck and half a dozen soldiers to collect the weapons from the 4th South Johor Guerrilla Regiment of the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army, who had moved out of the jungles of Johor and set up base in the pre-war mental hospital asylum at Johor Bahru. We weren't to go armed. This would be quite unobtrusive because of the sensitivity. They were commanded by 5 British officers who had come in by parachute or submarine. Some of them had been planters in the area, rubber planters, before the war. And they had carried out guerrilla attacks on the Japanese during the occupation. The commander was a Major Durwood Syme, who I liaised directly with. And he and his officers were paying off these guerrillas. They were blowing off all their ammunition and shooting at a large, tall metal chimney. Bullets were flying all over the place, and it was quite a Guy Fawkes Night scenario, with the possibility of injury or death at any moment. The weapons being handed in were both Japanese and British. Japanese grenades, explosive. They were being paid a lump sum gratuity on being disbanded. They were being paid so much for each weapon handing in, and money was changing hands like confetti. But the British officers with the guerrillas and we ourselves knew that they would be keeping whatever they needed back in the jungle for their own uses at a later date. My lads loaded up our first vehicle load, and I moved away from the area where they were handing it in so that we could sort it out in a quiet location. and we stopped near some empty houses, one of which was occupied by the British officers, obviously the pre-war medical officers' quarters. And the driver and a soldier and I commenced sorting out the weapons. And I said, put the Japanese rifles there, the Sten guns here, the British rifles there, the grenades and explosive here. One of the weapons I picked up was a Japanese rifle from which the butt had been cut off, roughly close to the trigger mechanism, and the barrel had been shortened so that it could be carried under clothing and used for bumping off a collaborator, possibly, in a market. This would be done before they got any British or American pistols. Amongst the weapons, in fact, was the first Browning 9mm self-loading pistol that the British Army uses today that I had seen. So I acquired that for myself. I passed this to the driver to put onto the pile of Japanese weapons. He turned round with it and promptly pulled the trigger and shot the soldier, Private Zhao, through the thigh. The shot rang out, a shriek ran out, and Zhao disappeared off the tailboard of the vehicle, flat on his back. And I thought, oh Christ, it shot him. Anyway, he looked very much alive, and obviously by the red stain on his trousers, was hit in the thigh. I pulled his trousers down, keeping him flat on his back, and sure enough, not only had he been hit in the thigh, but an artery had been cut, and the blood was spouting out with the beat of his heart. I slammed my fist on it, and said to the driver, fetch one of the British officers. We've got to get this chap to hospital. I couldn't use the Bedford because it was full of weapons, ammunition and explosives. I kept my fist hard on Private Zhao's thigh, and in excitement I forgot about the hole on the other side. So after a couple of minutes I said, ease up a bit and we'll see if you're bleeding at the other side. The hole was there, but luckily there was no blood coming out. I kept full pressure on with my fist until the British Major arrived back with the driver. And I was then able, with my free hand, to get a first field dressing out and apply the field dressing, a tourniquet. The Major sent for one of his guerrillas to bring a little van that they had. We pulled a door off one of the buildings, and using the door as a stretcher, got Zhao onto it, shoved in the back of the van. I left the very shaken driver behind and said, get hold of the NCO and carry on sorting the weapons. And a Chinese guerrilla driving, the Major and I set off on a hair-raising drive to the Johor Bahru Hospital, which of course the Army, Royal Army Medical Corps, were running. It was the nearest thing to the Cresta run I've ever taken part in, but we did arrive in one piece. Got him to hospital. He was operated on shortly afterwards, and the bullet, fortunately, had only snicked the artery. It had cut it, but they were able to repair it. At the time, when I was alone with him, I thought he might well die from loss of blood, but the force of my fist, and then later the tourniquet, averted this. I had seen people die from gunshot wounds and loss of blood. Seen and heard, not a very pleasant incident. And at one stage I contemplated that if, through loss of blood, poor Private Zhao had deteriorated, I was quite prepared to knock him out, to spare him suffering. Fortunately, this extreme action was not required. On the way back from the hospital to the aptly, appropriately designated a mental hospital. The driver again was doing his Cresta run act, and I said to this major, tell your chap to slow down or we're the next three into the hospital. We got back and carried on with our sorting out of the weapons and spent the rest of the day doing that. My first port of call was not back to the battalion but to the causeway at Johor Bahru and sling the explosives and the grenades into the water.
Did this necessitate, this kind of accident necessitate a great deal of form writing and reporting?
There was a board of inquiry, just a routine board of inquiry, and I was able to visit Jow the following day and subsequent days, and he was soon back with the back of the battalion within 3 weeks, and in very good form. He was a very hale and hearty fellow. He had the opportunity and took it to tell the driver what he thought of him when he was laid on the ground with me keeping the pressure up on his bullet wound. I still have the inventory of the weapons that I took, also with Major Syme's signature on. And he was a very interesting chap, come from Australia by submarine, and he and another of his colleagues and landed on the Johor coast and met up with the guerrillas. And I think the major who helped me with Private Jow, he might well have come in by parachute. I met Derwood Syme once or twice subsequently. Then I think he would go over to Java and then back into rubber planting.
Was it routine to drop weapons just into a stream or what have you?
It was only the grenades and explosives that were very dodgy and sensitive that I put into deep water off the causeway. But all the weapons went back through the correct channels. In addition to collecting weapons from the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army, or the Three Star Boys as we called them, because in addition to a small cap badge, they had three red stars on the front of their pixie-type hats, denoting the Communist Parties of India, Malaya and China. On one occasion, a Chinaman came to say that there was a collaborator living nearby, would we pick him up? And a platoon was sent under Lieutenant Ken Gregson into the jungle and overgrown rubber plantation not far from the barracks. Whether this chap was a collaborator or what, I would not know, nor perhaps did anyone else other than this Chinaman who was perhaps getting his own back for something that happened previously. But the fellow concerned and wisely ran away and was shot dead. Also on reoccupation, I took a platoon by landing craft from the naval area in the northeast corner of the island down the straits to the mainland, Pengerang, which was a naval and wireless station covering the entrance to the Johor Straits, and we were the first troops back there. Everything had been ripped out by communist guerrillas and local Chinese people looting, so only the building itself was all that remained. But we were the first chaps ashore. There was no opposition either from guerrillas or local people or any type of local villain, brigands and the like. But thereafter, 2DLI maintained a presence there with a small platoon garrison. But it was great fun to be back on operations again and being the first British troops back into Pengerang after the Japanese surrender.